Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled Running the Gauntlet. The featured speaker is author Barbara Mason, whose book, Gauntlet, Five Friends, 20,000 Enemy Troops, and the Secret That Could Have Changed the Course of the Cold War, tells the true story of courage and daring against overwhelming odds in 1950s Czechoslovakia. Tonight's discussion is moderated by Igor Lukas, University Professor and Professor of International Relations at Boston University. We begin with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grzenska-Gross.
Our guest today is Barbara Mason. She came to us from California. She will talk to us and then she will have a conversation with our colleague from Boston University, Professor Igor Lukas, whom I'm going to introduce very shortly. Professor Lukas comes originally from Czechoslovakia, like the father of our author also comes from there. And he's our colleague at Boston University, as I said, and he directs here Russian and East European Studies program, is university professor, professor of international relations, and professor of history. And his specialty is history of Central Europe in the 20th century. He has written about Europe between world wars and about contemporary developments in East Central Europe, in Russia, and in the Balkans. He published in very numerous periodicals, and he's also author of the book Czechoslovakia Between Stalin and Hitler, The Diplomacy of Edvard Beneš in the 1930s. The book was published by Oxford University Press in 1996 and won the Boston Authors Club Award as well as the Cannes Award. I will now leave the rest of the evening for the conversation that will start here. Thank you very much, Professor Lukas.
Well, thank you so much for this very detailed introduction. I'm grateful and thank you so much. And it's a true delight to see all of you here. I need to tell you that the story that you're about to hear is, in my opinion, one of the most, well, incredible and optimistic, life-affirming stories that have come out of that very tragic part of the world in the lands between Germany and Russia. I'm not going to bore you with any lengthy introduction. I will say simply that it is a story that most Central Europeans, certainly in Czechoslovakia, have grown up with. Our honored guest's father and her uncle were the sons of perhaps the bravest and most noble of the officers of the Czechoslovak army between the wars. He was a true hero. The word hero has been used, especially recently in the past several years, so often in so many different contexts that we almost have somehow lost a sense for it. But there, in fact, are heroes. And one of the heroes was Colonel Mashin. His bravery under unbelievable circumstances was truly, truly remarkable. And I think the best testament to that was that it was the Gestapo torturers who were awed by his sense of honor, sense of duty, and indeed by his personal courage. Driven by this incredible story of their father, the two young boys, the brothers Mashin, were already, even without having done anything at all, were already put on a path of collision, I think, with reality, because they were perhaps inevitably driven to somehow live up to the legacy of that great man who, even from heaven, somehow loomed larger than life and watched how his sons were doing. And the rest of the story is really for our wonderful guest here to tell. So it is my great honor and it is my great pleasure to introduce here Mrs. Barbara Mason, who has written a book that tells the story, which in my opinion is really one of the greatest and life-affirming stories ever to have come out of Central Europe. Please.
Thank you very much for that introduction. It's really a pleasure and a privilege being here with you today. I'm here to tell you a story. It's a story about a family and a country. It's a story about a country that was saved by America two times and about people who believed in America and what it stood for. And I grew up hearing this story as a little girl, and my father would tell it as a bedtime story in maybe three installments, and every time he would start, my mother would say, "Oh no, please don't tell them that story again, they'll never go to sleep." And you know what, she was right. Once he started, we just had to hear the end of it. He would speak about the quest that he, his brother, and three friends undertook in October of 1953. Their plan was to join the U.S. Army because they knew that an invasion was coming, an invasion just like the one that had come in 1944 in Normandy and that had come under the auspices of the United States and had saved Europe from a terrible scourge of the Nazi domination. A few years later, by 1948, their country had been consumed by another scourge, that of the communists. And once they saw what that regime was inflicting on their fellow countrymen, they knew that they had to do something about it. So by 1953, they decided that the only path open to them was to join the U.S. Army. By that point, the borders to the west were closed. It wasn't possible anymore to go into Austria or West Germany directly. So they decided to cross into East Germany, a fellow socialist country. That border was also guarded, but not to the same extent as the borders between Czechoslovakia and West Germany and Austria. So they believed they might have some trouble at the border, and that maybe 3 or 4 days walking and hitching rides on trains, they might be able to make it to Berlin and sign up at the U.S. Army recruiting office. Well, there were five of them. My father, who was 21 at the time, my uncle was 23, two friends who were 22 years old, and an older friend who was 31. And between the five of them, they took four pistols. They were going to travel lightly. They thought there might be some trouble at the border. Little bit food, and that was pretty much it. Maps were hard to come by in communist Czechoslovakia. Simply possessing one could set you up for charges of treason if you were discovered with a detailed roadmap. So they had a couple compasses, and they could navigate by the North Star. So that was pretty much the extent of what they had in the way of equipment. What actually happened, the 3 or 4 days that they had planned for their trip became 31 days. They had to shoot their way out of 6 encirclements, and in the end, they were chased by up to 20,000 Soviet and East German troops all the way to West Berlin. Of the five, three made it, two did not. When my father told the story, my sister and I, we would always hope against hope that maybe this time in this telling, the other two might make it. Of course, they never did. My father told the story with tremendous detail. It was as if it was seared into his mind. The first encounter, when they crossed the border into East Germany, they actually had no trouble at all. There was a lot of tension. They had a great fear that they might run into a border patrol, but in the end, it was eventless. The trouble started at Ukro train station. Ukro is a small town about 60 miles south of Berlin, and it doesn't appear on most maps. But when they got off the train at that train station, a suspicious employee had reported them simply because they spoke Czech with an they spoke German with an accent. In those days in East Germany, that was enough to get you reported. And they were met by 10 Volkspolizei men, people's policemen, an action response team that was armed with assault rifles. They were put in a corner, And instead of letting themselves be let off, they shot their way out. And at that point, the manhunt was on. The alarm bells rang all the way up to the Department of Interior, to the Minister of Interior. So the entire chain of command up to the Minister of Interior was alerted. In short order, there were tens of thousands of troops in the field. And the reason for that, my father could never really tell me. It seemed amazing to me that there were five young men armed with four pistols, and that the East German military had mobilized to that extent, and that there were even Soviet troops chasing them. So after that point, they had several additional encounters. After the train station encounter, one of their friends was separated, and he was ultimately picked up about 2 days later. At another shootout, they were encircled in a little copse. About 1,000 troops surrounded a little patch of forest that was about 150 meters across. They parked trucks in a circle around the forest at night with headlights on, put out searchlights and machine guns, all in an effort to annihilate four young men. They were able to break out of this encirclement, but one of their friends was shot, and he was ultimately caught as well and imprisoned. So the remaining three ultimately made it to Berlin, but not before two of them had to run across a Soviet army camp. So basically they had to climb the fence and run through the whole camp in order to make it out the other side and continue their way to Berlin. When they finally made it there, the survivors did sign up for the U.S. Army. The two that did not make it were turned over to the Czechoslovak communist authorities. A show trial was put on, and they were sentenced along with about two dozen other people to long jail sentences. Three were sentenced to death, ultimately. My father never really spoke about what came before or what came after these events, and I couldn't really get him to talk about it. My sister and I both tried many times, but he always begged off. He said he was too tired. It was just too difficult. He didn't have time. I asked him to teach us the language. He wouldn't do that. He said it was too difficult and we should learn something like French or Spanish, which had more immediate applications. So I eventually realized that my father really didn't want to talk about it. And ultimately, I decided after, during my time in college, I did some research. I tried to find out more about the story in books in the library, talking with people who were at the university. And unfortunately, there really wasn't very much about Czechoslovak resistance in the 1950s. So ultimately, I gave up and let it rest there. Things changed after 1989. In 1989, I was studying in Germany, and finally it seemed, the wall came down and the Velvet Revolution toppled the communist regime in Czechoslovakia. It was a totally overwhelming moment. My father had not expected this to happen in his lifetime, and when I spoke to him on the and watching the images of people partying in the streets in Berlin and breaking down the wall in the center of Berlin, he was as amazed as I was. And ultimately, his response was that he did not expect this to happen at all during his lifetime. After the Velvet Revolution happened, in the following 4 or 5 years, there was a procession of reporters that came to Santa Barbara to speak with my father. They asked the same questions over and over again, and my father patiently answered them. The questions were, well, why did you shoot people? Wasn't it an excessive amount of violence? Aren't you sorry about what you did back then in the 1950s? And my father stuck by his guns and said no. He believed he had done the right thing. It was a terrible, murderous regime, and he had to do everything that he possibly could to ensure its downfall. He kept answering the questions, and I think as a result of them, he was willing to finally open up a little bit and speak to me about the things that he was not willing to speak about before. What had happened before his effort and afterwards, his effort to leave the country, and he had just, and what had motivated him to do this. When I was younger, we had in our house books that were written in Czech, which was a language that I didn't understand, had a lot of consonants in it, not very many vowels. And when I tried to figure out what they said by using a dictionary, even then it really wasn't possible because the way the words, the declension of the words, it just made it very difficult to find them in the dictionary. So there were some pictures in these books showing my grandfather, who was a very aristocratic-looking man in a uniform, and I could tell underneath it said Joseph Mason Colonel, but it, other than that, there really wasn't much information. So my father had not wanted to translate these, but after these reporters started coming, he was willing to talk about what was in those books, and he even helped me translate some of the letters that were in there. And one that specifically stood out was this one. It was a letter that was written by my grandfather to his children shortly before his death. "My dear children," he wrote, "I send you this letter before my departure into eternity. My last thought is of you, and I'm especially sad that you are still small and in need of my greatest care. Unfortunately, I must leave you. Today you will not yet comprehend everything, but when you are older, I'm sure you will understand me. I fought for our dear homeland and nation. I do not wish for you to live as slaves in the future. Rather, you should live as liberated and free citizens. Remember that the first obligation of every conscious Czech is to defend the freedom of the nation. You too must in the future proceed in this way. In this fight, I was vanquished. I believe, however, that our sacred cause will prevail. Your loving father." This was the last will and testament of a father to his sons. The two boys never discussed the letter after that reading, but it became the single most powerful influence in their lives. Their father had dedicated his life to fighting for freedom. To the bitter end, he'd refused to compromise his principles. It was this patriotism, this sense of duty and honor, that he bequeathed to his sons. So young Pepa and Radek Mason were only teenagers when the communist putsch took place in 1948. They saw how some of their family's friends, opponents of the communist regime, were silenced, vanished without a trace, or sentenced to death in public show trials. Milada Horakova, a prominent early victim, had been a friend of their mother's. She was a member of parliament and a leader of the Czechoslovak women's movement. This was like no trial under the democratic government. Judges, prosecution, and even the defendants' attorneys joined together in hurling accusations and abuse at the defendants. Progressive workers, in the invitation-only audience, carried signs calling for Horakova's death. Mailbags full of spontaneous letters, over 6,000 of them, demanded that the judges liquidate these enemies of the people. Entire classes of school children wrote letters calling for Horakova's death in wobbly block letters. Horakova stood her ground with courage, but she was executed on fabricated charges of high treason. Her real crime, she had courageously and publicly objected to the communist power grab. General Pika, a hero of World War II, also arrested and sentenced on fabricated charges, had been a friend of their father's. This was exactly the kind of regime their father, in his testament, had told them to fight. Radio Free Europe was promising that the Americans were coming soon. Radek, Pepa, and a few like-minded friends decided that they had to fight, but they needed weapons and ammunition. In 1951, the group raided two police stations. Each time a policeman was killed. The other witnesses were put to sleep with chloroform but left alive. The communists, meanwhile, were clamping down. Owning a copying machine could land you in jail. Carrying a detailed roadmap was punishable as treason. If you visited friends overnight in a different town, you had to get your paper stamped by the local police station. You couldn't take a car more than 50 miles from its place of registration without submitting a request for permission and receiving police approval in advance. Since it was becoming increasingly difficult to conduct active actions, Pepa and Radek decided to go west. Their goal was to get some real training in partisan fighting techniques from the Americans. They believed a shooting war was imminent, and they wanted to return to Czechoslovakia in the vanguard of the liberating Western armies, just like the men of an earlier generation had, fighting against Hitler on Normandy's beaches with the liberating armies. A first escape attempt failed. The CIC operative, who they had agreed to smuggle out, was picked up by the STB, the Czechoslovak secret police. During his interrogation, he named Radek. Both brothers and their uncle were arrested by the secret police and subjected to the usual persuasive interrogation methods the STB reserved for its captives. But Pepa, Radek, and Borek didn't break. The STB never found out that they had seized the men responsible for the police station raids. Pepa and his uncle were released after 3 months. Radek was sentenced to 2 years slave labor for the crime of knowing about someone else's planned escape, but not reporting it. He was sent to the Yakimov uranium mines, the Czechoslovak answer to the Soviet gulag. Once Radek saw the inside of the Yakimov labor camp and the brutal abuse and starvation inflicted on the captives, he became even more determined to fight the regime. The others decided they had to continue their fight, and above all, they needed to fund more actions. They attacked a payroll transport for a state-owned factory and obtained 846,000 Czechoslovak crowns. A militiaman pointed his gun at Pepa, who disarmed him in a furious struggle, shooting the man in the process. In October 1953, the group made a second attempt to reach the Americans. RFE made it sound like World War III was imminent, and the Masons and their friends wanted to take part in the invasion. They would join the U.S. Army Special Forces and return to liberate their country. So when they started on this trip, they were really following in the footsteps of their father. Among the Czech military men, there were three who were, I would say, among the leading lights of the Czechoslovak resistance in World War II. One was Joseph Mason, another was Václav Moravec, and the third was Joseph Balaban. Collectively, they're known as the Three Kings. Three Kings were probably the greatest nemesis of the Gestapo in occupied Bohemian lands during the Second World War. They ran an underground operation, basically going after high-profile targets right in the middle of Berlin. They exploded bombs in the air ministry and in the police directorate. They also went after Heinrich Himmler himself, the number two man in the Nazi state. They exploded a bomb in the Anhalt railway station, and that basically missed Heinrich Himmler's personal train by 10 minutes. The train was late, believe it or not, in Germany. So they ran a sabotage campaign destroying telephone lines, railway lines, bridges, and fuel depots. They planted up to 2,000 bombs throughout the German Reich during this period. They got hold of blueprints on new German weapons and shipped them to London, including the Tiger tank and a new double-barreled machine gun. And they had René. René was really Paul Tümmel, a trusted employee of the Abwehr, which was Canaris's counterintelligence apparatus. He was probably the best-placed agent that the Allies had at that time. He provided the Three Kings with information about Hitler's military strategy, about the invasion of Poland, about Operation Sea Lion, the planned invasion of Great Britain, and the planned and also Operation Barbarossa, the German invasion of the Soviet Union. In May of 1941, on the eve of Barbarossa, the Gestapo burst into the Three Kings safe house in mid-transmission. Mason covered his associate's escape. There was a gun battle, and at the end, they captured him. The family didn't know what had happened to him. For 5 years, they searched and they hoped. And then in 1946, in a crack in the prison wall, wardens found the piece of folded toilet paper. It was the letter that I read to you. This was the farewell letter that Joseph Mason had written to his three young children before his execution. So that was really what motivated my father and uncle in their campaign. I didn't really know any of this when I was growing up. My father would not talk about his grandfather. All he would tell us is, the Masons fight for freedom, and you should be proud of the Mason name. About his mother, he didn't say much either. He only said, those communist bastards murdered her. That was it. Well, I found out Later, when my father started speaking more freely after 1989, that his mother was one of those imprisoned after my father and uncle's escape. She got a 25-year sentence, but she ended up dying in prison, basically on a concrete floor. And she had no way really to communicate with her family before her death. And I think that my father, although he would never have changed what he did, he always believed that he did the right thing, he felt guilt at his mother's death. His mother would not have died had my father and uncle not undertaken the actions that they did. So this was, I believe, a very heavy burden for him to bear. I really only saw him cry once in my life, and that was when he read me his father's letter, when he translated it. And I think that to this day, it really, the message in it really moves him profoundly. It was his kind of guiding light, what has always motivated him in his life. And basically, while this manhunt was going on, when I did the research, it was I decided that I was going to investigate not only what my father's side of the story was, but to see what the other side was thinking, what was going on there. So I decided to go into the archives in East Germany, in Berlin, and also to try to find out what the Soviets were thinking and doing, and also what the Americans were thinking and doing while this huge mobilization was going on in East Germany. The results were really quite interesting because, as it turned out, in West Berlin, the CIC had no idea what was going on. Clearly, there was a huge mobilization going on in the East Zone, and I believe the term today is a massive intelligence failure. Western analysts just couldn't believe that all of this turmoil was going on in the East Zone, that it was caused by five Czechs, so they were looking for other explanations. Military training maneuvers, a major uprising in East Germany, Polish and Ukrainian partisan armies fighting their way west. There were even rumors of pitched battles between the East German People's Police and the partisans. The Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, a very respected daily in West Germany, reported that 500 to 1,000 Czech, Polish, and German partisans were allegedly trying to make breakthrough to Berlin. The Boston Daily Globe reported a spreading revolt by Red Army deserters, anti-communist East Germans, and Czech partisans, and it went on to say, "It's not clear whether there is a liaison between several reported bands. It is known, however, that their numbers are large enough that they have engaged Soviet and East German People's Police units in pitched battles, and that 10,000 or more Red Army troops and communist police have been ordered out in the Berlin area alone in an attempt to root them out." The West Berlin Neue Zeitung spoke of a growing resistance army comprised in part of Soviet deserters, including the commandant of a Soviet airbase. An unnamed London source even claimed that an East German underground army, some 5 to 10,000 strong under a unified command, was fighting some 3,000 crack Soviet army troops sent into East Germany with orders to crush an anti-communist resistance movement operating hit-and-run guerrilla warfare. So there were no uprisings or resistance armies in operating under a command, unified or otherwise. There were only five young Czechs carrying a message from a Czechoslovak general who were trying to reach the Americans in Berlin at all costs. So they, before my father's departure, he was approached by a friend of his father, someone who had been active in the home resistance, and who had kept contact with the family even after the end of the World War. This man, even after the communist putsch, continued to hold a command in the army. He was a general officer, and he was in charge of a division that was deployed along the border. He told my father this: "When the Americans invade, I can deliver 14,000 men." That was it. So basically, when my father and uncle left for Berlin, they were carrying this message, and they wanted to deliver it to the best placed person that they could within the CIC. My father really didn't inquire in great detail what that message was about, primarily because, in some respects, the less one knows, the better in the event one is captured. But they did have with them a dictionary, a code book, and their uncle, was ready to receive a transmission as soon as one would be forthcoming. So unfortunately, the time for the invasion never came. This General Vaniek waited, obviously to no avail, and probably 2 years later, he was relieved of his command in the ongoing process of political cleansing that the army was going through. So basically, they were convinced that they had to reach Berlin at all costs, and three of them did. But back in Czechoslovakia, 120 people were arrested, and most of these had no idea that there even had been a resistance group. So the Czechoslovak Communist Party Central Committee, which was the highest judicial, political, legislative, and economic authority in the land, met five times to decide what everyone's sentences would be, who would be sentenced to death, who would be sentenced to life imprisonment, and what everyone else's sentences would be. So you have to imagine the judicial situation. The party was the judge, the jury, and the prosecution. So the three survivors who reached Berlin were offered university scholarships to any school of their choice. They got offered book deals and movie deals, but they refused all of this. They declared that they'd come to join the army and fight the communist dictatorship to free their country. And the first thing they did was join the special forces with the hope and the expectation that there would be a war of liberation. In June of 1956, there was a workers' strike in Poland, which was savagely beaten down by the military, and the United States did nothing. A few months later, in October, students and workers took to the streets of Budapest, Hungary. This was a broad-based popular revolt by a nation against their communist oppressors. Eisenhower had talked tough against the communists during the election campaign. He declared that official U.S. policy wasn't containment. No, it went beyond that, rolling back communism. Congress had voted $100 million to fund a fighting force of East European exiles. RFE and VOA broadcast that the U.S. was making preparations to confront the Soviet Union, and the Hungarians took the U.S. at its word. Radek, Pepa, and Milan waited for word that the special forces would be airlifted in to help the rebels. Soviet tanks rolled into the country, and the United States again did nothing. More than 30,000 Hungarians died, and hundreds of thousands fled across the borders. U.S. government policymakers later acknowledged that inflammatory broadcasts of VOA and RFE were largely responsible for the Hungarian uprising. Forced to face the horrific consequences of its policy of inciting rebellions, it had no intention of supporting. The Eisenhower administration conducted a tactical retreat. It toned down the rhetoric on VOA and RFE broadcasts. Radek, Pippa, and Milan were bitterly disillusioned. Obviously, the Western allies had no intention of putting their money where their mouths were. All hope of a Soviet demise was dashed. They had paid a bitter price for their belief in American promises. They would never see their families again. Friends and family members paid the ultimate price, sentenced to death or spending years in communist prisons. My father remained a firm believer in American ideals, and he always told us that at its best, the United States was a beacon of hope for peoples oppressed by dictatorships. But he was also a pragmatist. He lived in the present and planned for the future, putting the past behind him when all recourses had been exhausted. During the communist era, the Czechoslovak government had featured the Mason case in books, articles, and films. The Mason group was portrayed as public enemy number one, a collection of bloodthirsty, drunken hooligans, and casual murderers in the service of Western imperialists. State TV dramatized one of the group's raids in a segment of the 30 Cases of Majo Zeman, a cops and robbers show in which the detective hero took on the Communist Party's enemies in historical sequence, from Nazi-era collaborators to a banned rock group modeled on Plastic People of the Universe. After the Velvet Revolution, public interest in the Mason case crescendoed. The Kausal Mašín, as it is known in the Czech Republic today, quickly became a flashpoint of controversy that sharply illuminated the fissures in the nation's body politic. Heroes, murderers, patriots, gangsters, conscience of the nation, bloodthirsty pariahs. All those terms were applied to my father, my uncle, and their associates. There's a striking paradox at the heart of the Kausal Mašín. The national consensus today is that armed resistance against the Nazi regime was moral and necessary, but many Czechs feel ambivalent about armed resistance against the communists. On the one hand, Josef Mašín Sr. is canonized as a national hero for his armed fight against Nazi oppression. On the other, his sons, who used many of the same methods in their fight against the equally ruthless communists, are the subjects of a political debate on morality. General Mashin's organization planted 2,000 bombs in Reich factories, staged assassination attempts on Himmler, and exploded bombs in the Ministry of Aviation and the Reich Police Directorate. There is no doubt that civilians were injured and killed in the actions conducted by the Three Kings directly or as a result of intelligence they furnished to the Western Allies. But Czechs concur that even civilian casualties, though regrettable, were acceptable and justified in the struggle against the Nazi dictatorship. In fact, General Mašín was posthumously awarded a number of medals and promotions for his resistance activities. Most recently, his promotion to Major General, voted on by the Czech Parliament and signed by the Czech President in 2005. His son's resistance activities resulted in a mere 6 deaths. 3 were armed East German troops, 2 were armed Czech policemen, and 1 was an armed Czech militiaman who pulled his weapon on my father, who was unarmed at the time. The reasons for this remarkable bipolar thinking are complex and deeply rooted. It is not that the communists in the 1950s were somehow practicing a kinder, gentler form of totalitarianism than the Nazis in the 1940s. They were not. It is not that they murdered fewer people. They did not. Instead of race genocide, the communists practiced class genocide. However, the nature of the West's conflict with communism evolved differently from its conflict with Nazism. In the 1950s, both Americans and Europeans believed that a Third World War in the European theater was a real and imminent danger. After the Hungarian uprising of 1956, the threat of war receded. It was clear to everyone on both sides of the Iron Curtain that the Americans wouldn't intervene on behalf of the captive peoples in Eastern Europe. By 1975, the Helsinki Accords set the stage for an ongoing dialogue. Détente and rapprochement were the buzzwords of the era. The communist regimes also evolved over time. Younger generations who came of age in the 1970s and 80s have no recollection of the Stalinist terror of the 1950s. It was not talked about in most homes. It was not taught in the schools. The East Bloc baby boomers experienced the years of détente and the Helsinki Accords. The Communist Party of their day was effete and complacent, led by a group of geriatric apparatchiks. It was inefficient, perhaps, corrupt, certainly, but not all that bad if you could put up with the petty indignities, a low standard of living, and the lack of civil liberties. Opposing the regime could still get you locked up, but in the 1970s, a prison sentence was not an implied death sentence, as it so often was in the 1950s. Why does Czechoslovakia's inaction with respect to the country's communist past matter? The problem is that the past continues to inform the present and the future as well. The bitter conflict about the Mason case is merely one small symptom of a much larger ill. The promised reforms of the early years are petering out in political compromises and corruption at the highest levels. The same communist-era laws that legalized state-sponsored property theft, murder, torture, and blackmail continue on the books today. The same judges continue judging. The same bureaucrats who benefited from the graft-ridden, corrupt command economy under communism continued in their positions of power in the ministries, in the largest national enterprises, and in the provincial government offices. Instead of a break with the past, continuity was and is the name of the game. The lesson to those paying attention was simple. Collaboration pays. Those who had not joined the party, who had struggled against the regime and lost their homes, their businesses, their livelihoods and sometimes many years of their lives were the big losers. Integrity, hard work, and personal responsibility counted for nothing. As one observer pointed out, the police do not need to catch all the criminals all of the time for most people to submit to public order, but they need to catch a significant proportion. Nothing encourages lawlessness more than the sight of villains getting away with it, living off their spoils, and laughing in the public's face. By contrast, the Nazi Reich was totally annihilated and its leaders were held publicly accountable for their crimes. In 1945, West Germany lay prostrate and received a new democratic constitution from its occupiers. This constitution still continues in force today. A number of high-ranking Nazi officials were brought to justice in widely publicized trials, and the National Socialist Party was banned. As a result, National Socialism as an ideology was thoroughly discredited. Whereas in the former West Germany, neo-Nazis are ostracized, existing as pariahs on the political and social margins. In Eastern Europe, it is quite acceptable and respectable to be a communist. And therein lies the crux of the problem. If the Czech Republic and the other countries of the former Soviet bloc fail to come to grips with their totalitarian past, the old elites and their protégés will keep their hold on power. They will become more confident and act with greater impunity to smother the nascent stirrings of a free press, eliminate their political opponents, and prevent the development of the rule of law and an independent apolitical judicial system. The epochal defeat of communism, which seemed to usher in a new era of freedom and democracy just a few years ago, is threatening to become a hollow promise. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your thoughtful and deep and provocative and always elegant remarks. I'm truly grateful. And I think that we now have an opportunity to perhaps have a conversation. And the anybody?
I just want to come with some easy question on you. Being a Czech origin, how difficult was it for you to go through documents which were related to your father's case?
Well, when I went to Czech Republic, I had a very interesting experience. When I went to the German archives, it was relatively straightforward. In Germany today, the people who had the skeletons in the closet are in no position to kind of defend the data. So all of the records of the Volkspolizei from 1953, I had free access to it. It was just a question of finding it. In Czech Republic, when I went there in 2001, because the Mašín name is so well known there, when I called the archives and contacted archivists, people immediately knew who I was. But the reaction I got was rather surprising. It was, you know, I'd love to help you, but please don't call me at the office. I'll meet you in the park behind a tree. You know, this was 2001, you know, after the Velvet Revolution, and it was still. Today, the situation with my father's case is such that people really don't feel 100% secure about it. And as far as the documentation was concerned, I really only got a portion of it, a very small portion. My father's case was still active until, I believe it was 1996. It was in the Mieste Statni Zastupitelstvi, and ordinarily the statute of limitations dictates that after 50 years, if a case hasn't been acted upon, it's closed, it's retired to the archives, but that was not the case with my father's case. So I went to the Mieste Statni Zastupitelstvi with a power of attorney from my father and one from my uncle, and they still wouldn't let me look at the documents. So, you know, there was some hasty consultation back and forth behind the scenes, and I was presented with a letter the next day that maybe if one of the accused in question showed up at the state prosecutor's office, they might let him look at it, at the documentation. So, you know, my father and uncle have always said that they refused to return to Czech Republic until this problem of the Vergangenheitsbewältigung, this continuity, is resolved. Milan Palmer has returned, the third individual has returned. He now lives in Poděbrady. And so he courageously enough volunteered to go. So he got a look at some of the documents, but not all, and he wasn't allowed to photocopy anything. So it was definitely an interesting paper chase. Yeah.
Yes.
Hi. I know from history that usually the ruling party usually makes the rules. And unfortunately, whether it's Nazis, whether it's communist, whether it's Habsburg's empire, my family was always on the wrong side, so we always lost something. So during the Habsburg Empire and the Kossuth Uprising, we lost part of huge land under High Tatras. During the Nazis, my family hided the Jewish family and risked their life hugely, so there is again on the wrong side. During the communism, they lost everything, whatever they had, and collected during 1,000 years that my family tree goes back to, and I can trace it. So I just wanted to say that, unfortunately, these things happen. The ruling party makes the rules, and bloodshed is always going to be there, whatever happens. And I'm looking forward to read the book, and I think whoever reads their lives for something they believe should be praised for, and I'm so happy that you took the part and wrote the book. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
I just wondered if you could say a little more about the process of writing the book, what brought you to write it, and what emotions you had writing it. And I also wanted to ask about a novel you surely know about, So Far, So Good, by Jan Novák, which won the Czech equivalent of the National Book Award a couple of years ago. And I wondered if you had a chance to read it, if you had any thoughts on it, and if you could, if in any ways his narrative is different from yours. It's also quite favorable to your family, yeah. But I think he doesn't draw some of the conclusions that you draw. So yeah. Either of those questions, I'd be very curious to hear what you say.
Yeah. Well, what moved me to write the book? There was actually an earlier book that was written by one Ota Rambošek.
Jenom nestrach,
that's right. Just Don't Be Afraid. And this was actually based, it was a first-person narrative in the voice of my uncle, which was based on kind of a monograph that my uncle had prepared back in 1957 when the memory of all of these events was still fresh. My uncle had written it on a typewriter, and my father and Milan had kind of contributed their recollections as well. And this was really a very rich source because after 50 years, if people try to recall what happens, details often aren't quite there anymore. But this document was written not long after the events in question, and it was quite comprehensive. So Jenom nestrach was essentially this document. It was edited, written in the first-person voice of my uncle. And when this book came out, it became a massive bestseller in Czechoslovakia. But the reactions that came from people were, they're so extreme, they actually shot people. And that those reactions tended to come more from the younger generation, the people who'd grown up in the, you know, after 1968, and actually the 60s and 70s, who didn't really have any personal recollection of the Stalinist terror. The older people knew what the context was, but this book provided no context. Jan Novák's book, I read an original English manuscript that he had. Ultimately, it was published in Czech. I did read parts of that. My Czech is fair, and it's gotten worse since I really haven't used it very much since about 2001. So I couldn't read the whole thing in Czech, but it's extremely well written. It's a gripping thriller. But again, I think that it doesn't really provide the context. He worked with the same monograph. He interviewed my father and uncle, and those were his sources. My goal was to really tell the story from all sides, to not just draw on those sources, my father's telling and my uncle's telling in the monograph, but also to see what the other side had said and what moved the other side, because none of these earlier books really addressed the question of why would the government send 20,000 troops after five kids with four pistols. Seems like a real overreaction, if there was an overreaction anywhere in this whole thing. So I decided I had to go into the archives, which was why I went to Berlin. And I also spoke with eyewitnesses in East Germany. I was able to avail myself of eyewitness reports, even from people's policemen, those who had been active on the other side in the manhunt. And I tried to tell the story objectively that way, so that each side could kind of bring its point of view to bear. And that was new. You know, I also wanted to document what had happened because there was a lot of discussion in Czechoslovakia or Czech Republic today. Everyone has a very strong opinion on this, but no one really knows the facts. Most people, or no one, but very few people really knew the facts. There was the tales of Major Zeman, you know, and that was really where people got their information from. So what I wanted to do was really provide the factual background, the archival documentation, substantiate everything that had happened. So that's really what's new about my book. I tried to provide the historical context to explain the context of the times in which these actions had happened so that they don't exist in this vacuum, and to tell the story from all sides, really. Yeah.
Well, I can't help, but Before we conclude, I need to bring up again the image of the colonel who, after months of unspeakable torture, was able to write this last letter to his family in such an eloquent style. What sort of strength, what sort of intellect, in addition to the physical courage that he displayed, what sort of powerful intellect he must have had to be able to focus his thoughts at this incredible stage of his life, that he could write so eloquently to his family, and then to hide it in a small hole in the wall of his death cell before he was dragged for his execution. And then his wife, by complete coincidence actually, runs into somebody who says, "Oh, have you seen the letter? I heard that your husband hid it in his cell." "Which cell?" "Oh," and this person even knew the number, right? So this is how this whole thing evolved. So I think there is some light at this story. There is, in fact, plenty of it. One must look at the colonel and keep his eyes on him. That's essentially what I try to do. And I think the two Mashin brothers have been doing the same thing. So thank you so much for coming to Boston University. And on behalf of the Institute for Human Sciences, I just want to say thank you, and we're very grateful. Good night.
Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences titled Running the Gauntlet with author Barbara Mason. Tonight's discussion was moderated by Igor Lucas, university professor and professor of international relations at Boston University. We began with an introduction by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grzenska-Gross. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda with help from Rachel Paste. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.